Welcome to this new episode of Classicists in Transition, a podcast series by the Kent Institute for Classical Studies aimed at fostering a sense of community among the many members of its various classics departments. Today, for the seventh episode, we have invited Georgia Nicosia to come and talk about the theme of resilience. Georgia is a PhD student at the History Department at Ghent University, where she works on Syriac historiographical excerpt collections within the wider project This Story May Provide Proof, directed by Peter van Uffelen. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
So welcome to the podcast, Georgia. We're talking today with Georgia Nicosia, who's a doctoral researcher at the University of Ghent with Peter van Uffelen. So Georgia, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about the work that you do, what your research is about.
Sure, and thanks for having me here. I'm very happy to be here. Well, I'm part of a project called This Story May Provide Proof, History and Our Authority in Syriac Excerpt Collection and Beyond, which is a long title just to say that I work on Syriac historiographical excerpt collections, meaning, if I can use a very bad way of putting it, I do not work on complete histories, but on pieces of history put together. And with that, I mean that, as I said, I work in Syriac, but the histories, the stories I work on are all translated from Greek, but what we have are not complete translations. There were maybe complete translations. This is one of the issues and one of the main questions, but what I now have and what I'm looking at are not, as I said, complete translations, but just pieces of that history put together. So there are several points of interest and several questions. The first of that is why did someone chose that parts of the histories rather than others? So who translated them, maybe, even if that's a very complicated one. I mean, and with who translated it, I don't mean the person that did it, but the context or the aim. And so yes, this collection can be looked at in different ways. One can look at the collection as a whole. So the way the different excerpts are linked together, if there is a link, there is a collection, an idea behind it, or transversally. And with that, I mean that if I have different manuscript, which is the case, of course, different manuscript with different excerpts from the same Greek text, do I have to assume that they were all translated once and then scattered in different parts? Or can we have different hypotheses? So it's a bit of a puzzle in a way, but an intriguing one for me. There are, of course, also other points of investigation, because this collection come all from Miaphysite milieu. So there is a religious perspective behind it, possibly. And they were used, well, they were composed, this manuscript come from a period in which the Miaphysite church was shaping its identity. So another interesting question is, did this collection contribute to the identity formation process? And all these kind of different questions.
Okay, yeah, that sounds really interesting. Actually, I just have a question. It's probably a stupid one. Are these translations of sort of contemporary histories, like late antique histories, or is it also the sort of classicizing history, like earlier? Is it just sort of the contemporary Christian histories?
We have different cases. The manuscript I'm working on mainly contain Theodoret and Theocritus ecclesiastical histories, yeah. But I have excerpt also from Flavius Josephus. So
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah.
Precisely. And that is one of the main points. Like, why would Flavius Josephus be in a manuscript with Theodoret? Yeah, what's the idea behind it? I don't know yet.
Yeah.
I suppose, Georgia, that for this kind of study, the text and the corpus of text that you need to work on, that it requires quite a lot of work abroad, and that you can't always perform your research in Ghent, and as you know, a lot of researchers in Ghent have had that issue lately with not being able to continue with their research or doing it in other ways because of the current health situation. So I wonder if you felt that impact of COVID-19 in the last few months of your research, or how did you adapt according to these circumstances in your research?
That's a very good question. I felt it very much, but I was mm-hmm. also very lucky, so I can't complain because I'm working on mainly on an edited text, so I need picture of manuscript or manuscript themselves, and I have to go get them or buy them. Some manuscripts are at the British Library. So one of the main ideas of the project was just going to the library, to the British Library, and take images, which is of course not the case now because the library is closed. But one very important witness is and was in Deir al-Suryan, so in Egypt. And in that respect, I was surprisingly extremely lucky because I had the chance to go to Egypt this autumn mm-hmm. and consult the manuscript and have everything that I wanted, which was of course a challenge and a bit controversial in this time, but mm-hmm. it was very important for my research. Yeah. So it was a great opportunity.
How was it experience, I wonder, in traveling in for your research in times of COVID?
Very good. Mm-hmm. We started planning the journey already in February last year. And I was supposed to go like in autumn, as I said, or before summer. So I was in touch with a researcher, a young researcher in Paris.
Yeah.
She is also working on Syriac and Arabic, and she has a lot of experience in traveling abroad, and she has been to the monastery in Al-Suryan often. And she agreed on letting me go with her. So super exciting about that. We were preparing everything, and of course COVID came and everything was canceled. And suddenly, something like the first week of September or so, she texted me saying, "Hey, I'm going. Do you want to come?" And I was like, okay, first, when are you going? And secondly, yes, of course I do. And she was planning her journey for the last week of September. So that meant that I had a couple of weeks to prepare everything, including getting fundings. But of course, another important part of it was I need to be prepared for the journey. I mean, for my research there, because I cannot just enter a monastery and I like ask to see manuscript without knowing what I'm looking for or being prepared first. So I had 2 weeks, intensive weeks in which I needed to figure out everything. I had all the support I needed from my team and also from my family. But the fact was that I was in Belgium. So I needed to go back to Italy to get a passport in 1 week. Fun fact, fun story. I did get the passport there, and that was the plan. I was in Italy just for 2 days, and I needed to get the passport. And then on the Thursday, I wanted to go back to Belgium because on Friday, I had the first class, the day of class, because I was assisting a Byzantine history, and on Saturday, leaving. Fun story, on Wednesday night, midnight, I got mugged. So I lost all the documents, everything, money. I had no money. I had no document. I had no telephone, and I had a plan to catch the day after. I don't know how we did it, but the day after I managed to get on a flight with all my documents and a new credit card and a new passport.
Wow. So this was in December, right?
No, this was in September. Or
in September, from yes. this, for how long you were there?
3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah. And because now we have all those regulations of you have to get tested, you have to have a negative test or quarantine.
Back then too.
Back then, was it already like then? Did you need to get a test and stuff like that?
Yes, and there was another not sure thing because according to Egyptian law, the results needed to be in English.
Okay.
I did the test in Italy because I was there. And when I asked to have the results in Italy, they just laughed at me, saying, no way. So yeah, until the moment I was on that plane, I was not sure I was going there. I swear, I told my family that I would not, like, my mother, my father, my sister knew that, but the rest of my family that I was going to Egypt the moment I was on the plane.
But was it worth it when you got there? Was it worth it to see the manuscripts in the monastery? And was it, was it useful for your research?
Absolutely. It was incredible, not only for my research, but also on a more personal point of view. Getting to this monastery is very, very complicated. I mean, extremely complicated. And that's why I say I was extremely lucky. And without my colleague, Adis Krok, I would have never get inside the monastery. So I had access to a manuscript that is unpublished and that a lot of people want to see. So now I have this text, which is so exciting. And I consulted two manuscripts there, one for my research and for my current project, and one that is linked to my MA research and that I'm still working on. So yes, it was incredible. It's also because it was the first time, well, not the first time, because I've been in Venice, I've consulted some other manuscript, but it was the first time consulting Syriac manuscript. And I had in my hands manuscript coming from the 6th century or 9th century, so very old, precious, and rare manuscript over there. So yes, it was great. And I'm really happy I can work on this and maybe edit some of this text, which is, of course, a great opportunity considering that I'm just at the beginning of my PhD. So it's great. And it was also incredible on a personal point of view, as I said. It was the first time for me in Cairo. And it was, in a way, like going back to 2019, because there was no COVID there. Absolutely nothing. So it was like taking a break from all this bad feelings that one has here sometimes, and absolutely escaping from the sensation of being at risk. Of course, when I came back in Belgium, I quarantined, like I get tested again. I did everything not to endanger other people, but it was, yes, it was incredible. Absolutely worth it.
And a 6th century manuscript, that's so exciting. I mean, yes, I mean, well, especially like, I mean, I work on the West, so I mean, that's almost impossible, but wow, like something that actually is from so long ago. Yeah, that must have been so cool to actually see it and touch it and be able to go in and wow.
Your experience is quite a nice illustration of how to deal with this kind of unusual and uncertain circumstances, and I guess persistence in the end pays off. So that's a very positive a positive way of looking at it. But I'm also wondering in these times, in the fact that you come from abroad, you're Italian, you come and live in Ghent for your research, and I can imagine I've talked to a couple of expat colleagues in my department, and there is that feeling that for people not really familiar with the context or the social context here in Ghent, not having really a lot of context, you don't have a family history or a friend history in this country, that is quite difficult to experience or to live in these kind of unusual very antisocial times. Have you experienced difficulties in the sense of, I talked with some people who say, well, there's that kind of feeling of isolation, not seeing too many people, feeling a little bit detached also from Ghent University. How are you experiencing this, lockdown era in a sense?
In different ways. I didn't have just one feeling through the whole period. My family, like I come from Sicily, but I studied in another part of Italy. So I'm used to being outside home, like far from home and far from my family. And the fact that I'm now in a different country is not that big of a change, because Sicily is an island. So you have most of the time to get on a plane to go back home. So it just the duration of the flight, it changes. And yes, the language and the general context, but that was not an issue. I felt very much isolated and not part of my own country, nor the country I live in at the very beginning of the pandemic. because I was planning to go back to see my mom and the rest of my family, but I could not. And the feeling that you cannot go back home if you want to was scary at first, also because I have two sisters and one of them lives in Spain. The other one lives in another part of Italy, but now she's home with my mom again, but because of the pandemic. But when pandemic came, we were scattered in different countries with different regulations. And that was something very new. So at the beginning, that was scary.
Yes,
I have to say that, yes, it was new. It was scary. But it didn't last a lot, because I managed to find the good side of it, if I can say so. I don't mind being on my own in a way. I enjoyed the fact that I had no external distraction, so to say. So I could focus on my research. I could focus on things that I like and that I want to do. And I never lost connection with my team and my colleagues. My supervisor was always there, and my co-advisor also. So no, I did not feel isolated from that. Of course, I don't have a lot of experience with Jugend life in a way, because most of my experience come now online. But yes, I guess it's just different. Not bad, it's just different. But it's indeed reassuring knowing that despite the circumstances, I can just email a colleague, my supervisor, a friend, whoever, and they are there. So I guess that being part of a team and being part of a system and of a university also that supports you, it's indeed very, very helpful.
Yeah,
I mean, George and I started at Ghent at the same time, basically January 1st, 2020. Great time to move to a new country and start a new place. But I think, and obviously, like, it was hard at times, but I really do think that UGhent is a very, I mean, I think Dimitri and I have sang UGhent's praises in almost every episode.
That's true.
I really feel like they want to take care of their employees, and in the ancient history department, everyone is like very friendly, and we have a very nice team atmosphere. And our office has a little WhatsApp.
Yes.
it's quite nice. And also, I mean, for part of it, we were allowed to go back to the office. I mean, now not so much, but hopefully by the summer, we're allowed to go back to the office once a day again.
Ghent has been quite supportive, I guess, in this situation, and on different levels also, not only on the higher levels or the governance level, but even also within departments and research groups, and also in archaeology, we have kept contact with our colleagues. We have like a Facebook chat, and we keep regular contact. We have opportunities to have like coffee chats. So we try to do that as much as possible. And there's even been also a lot of initiatives within our faculty, from postdocs and from doctoral students, to start talking to each other about our problems, about our concerns, not only current concerns, but also towards the future, the impact of what the situation is going to have for their work in the future, I think Ghent for this is really kind of a unique and a nice environment, perhaps the best possible environment in these kind of weird times to work in. So yeah, I completely agree. Yeah.
Well, I even remember when I started in January, just thinking, like, before we even like thought the pandemic would happen, like, wow, like the history department is very social here, like in a good way. Like, they had all these things planned, and I thought, wow, okay, like, even coming from the Anglophone world, where everyone thinks, oh, like, you know, British and American universities do something, like, I was surprised at how social department is. It's very nice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and it's really important that we have this kind of support and contacts all the time. And it's true, I don't have a lot of experience in different university, but I do have the feeling that Ghent is unique
Well, despite being Ghent being a good environment in in uncertain times. I still get a feeling if I hear your stories and your telling of how your work went in Egypt and how you confront the opportunities and the disadvantages of lockdowns and pandemics since almost a year now. I get the feeling that you're quite a resilient person. So you chose the theme of resilience for this episode of our podcast, and I wonder if you talk about resilience and the fact of being someone who is resilient in her work or in her life, I wonder how that reflects on where you come from, in the sense of you told us you came from Sicily and now you're in Ghent. But so I'm wondering, how was that journey? How did you end up in Ghent, coming from a family in Sicily?
Well, if we talk about the topic resilience, I guess that the main point of it, but I guess that almost every researcher can relate to that, is that we are asked to move mm-hmm. often. And so resilience to me is also the ability to change from one city to another. And that's always challenging, meaning that at least according to my personality, when I move away, I really move away. Of mm-hmm. course, you keep in touch with people, but the kind of connection is a bit lost. So I did my BA in Siena, so in Tuscany, and my MA in Padua, near Venice, and now I'm here in Belgium, but I'm doing a coup d'etat, so a joint PhD. So next mm-hmm. year I'll be in Paris and then you go back again. And it's not only the fact that you have to move all your things and all your books and find a new apartment, but it's also the fact that you built a life, you have your contact, you have your friends, you have your habits, and then you have to change. And that can be very inspiring for some of us. I talked last year with a friend of mine who was moving from an apartment to another. And my reaction was, I'm sorry, can I have you? Like, I'm so sorry, you have to move again. And he instead replied, no, I'm super happy. I love the feeling of something new opening up and not knowing where I'm going. That is indeed true. It's also, it's always beautiful awaiting for new things to show up. But on the other hand, it's also, it can be very fatiguing. So it requires resilience.
Well, isn't, am I remembering correctly that Syriac studies is a bit of a family business for you?
Yes. Yes. Yes, my older sister, she is a linguist. She studies Semitic languages, and she was the one that introduced me, in a way, to this kind of word, because I studied classics, both in my BA and MA. And I did also, in Italy, we have the so-called classicalized school, even if it's a bad translation of it, mm-hmm. Meaning a high school where the main focus is on Latin, Greek, and philosophy. That was something quite normal. As I said, I come from Sicily, and growing up in Sicily is very easy that you are exposed to classical heritage. Like in Catania, my hometown, in the very city center, you have a Greek theater and an Odeon, or you can go to Taormina, to the Greek theater there, and you have Agrigento around the corner. It doesn't mean, of course, that this heritage is always valued or known, but it's there. It is absolutely there. And yes, my family also values this heritage. So for me, in a way, studying classic was very unnatural choice. But as I said, my sister, she is a linguist, and she did her PhD in Semitic languages. And she has an amazing way of letting people widen their scope. So anytime I was like, oh, Greek is amazing. Greek is the best thing on earth. I love Greek. She always said to me things like, okay, but there are other things. Like, open up, widen your horizon. Yes, Greek is cool, but there are other cool things, you know? So when I moved to Padua, she suggested me to contact a professor she knew there. And this professor taught and teaches history of Christianity. So it was like my first week in Padua. I just went to class and started listening to this professor talking. And I was amazed by the way he approaches the subject and the subject itself. It was really something unusual. So at the end of the lecture, I just approach him, so we start talking. And he did something amazing. He looked at me in the eyes and said, "Do you want to study Syriac?" And my reaction was, "Yes, why not?" And he taught me Syriac privately once a week in his office, just because he loves the subject and he mm-hmm. wants other people to know it. We don't have, and yeah, they don't have a subject, like a class of Syriac. But he is so fond of the subject that it's just, he's willing to teach you if you want to learn. And mm-hmm. that is amazing. It's absolutely uncommon. So it was, yes, a bit of a combination of things. And I'm so happy things developed in this way.
When you're telling this story, you sound like a very dynamic and person with like a very broad mentality and a wide view on the topics or the topics that you research or even the context in which you live. So I can imagine if your life went from Sicily to other parts of Italy towards Europe, now in Ghent, surely to Paris next year. And then also thematically, I hear telling about, well, I came from ancient Greek and then I went to Syriac and that was amazing, that transition between those two languages and how it enriched me. And in some way, it makes me think that you're not going to do this kind of research for the rest of your life. And I have a feeling that you will like finish this part of your research and then perhaps try to do something else in research or in education or whatever. So I wonder how do you see that future in academia? Do you see yourself working on these kind of documents or texts for longer periods still, or is this like a stage in something more broad? How do you see this journey?
That's a very good question. I hope I will be able to keep working on these things. Of course, I'm just at the very beginning of my PhD, so future is absolutely unknown, but I will be extremely happy to keep working on these things. I have to say, I'm trying to open up to Arabic, because yes, it's true, to Arabic as well, because most of the source, not most, but a lot of the sources are in Arabic or linked to Arabic. So not knowing Arabic is really something that could limit your research, but I don't wanna leave Syriac for good. I hope I will be able to keep working on Syriac. Of course, when it comes to the subject, there is no way of telling it because you need to see if there's a position opening or the kind of new text you discover. But yes, in a way, the feeling that I have while I do my research is that you never know where you will end up. Mm-hmm. Mostly because you work with unedited texts. So you never know what's in there or what you can find. But this is something I really like, even though it can be, once again, very fatiguing. Because you start with an idea and then you find something else, so you end up doing something different but still related, and you never know which shapes or direction your research will take. But yeah, I really like my work. I really like what I'm doing right now, so I don't want to leave it unless I have to.
That broad view on research, I think, is one of the advantages and one of the very positive aspects, I think, of academic research, is the fact that you are constantly moving forward, and if you're interested and if you have that curiosity, which most of us have, I guess, then you're constantly able to widen your view, to look at different contexts or see your topic or within a different perspective or see it from another angle. And I think the best research that I have encountered in my field, they do precisely that, in the sense that they don't stop at a particular point of learning, widening their view, getting more or a broader expertise or more views on the same topic. And I think that's one of the characteristics of a good research, in the sense that you purposely do that. Try to always widen and expand the issues that you are investigating. And I was thinking about so I guess languages have quite a central place in your life, in the sense of not only in the different contexts that you live in, but you're now talking about studying like your third or even fourth language, and not only for your research, but perhaps also in your communication with other people. And I wonder how that impacts your social life, in the sense, does it make you value more, or appreciate more the value of communication, the fact that you can communicate with other people and other cultures, but sometimes that's difficult. So the communication between people of different backgrounds, even within academia, can sometimes be very destructive or a real hindrance. So I wonder how you look towards that aspect of communication in different languages and between different cultures and societies.
Well, I have to say that I do not communicate with other people in that many languages because I feel like I can communicate well enough in Italian, of course, in English. When it comes to other languages, I'm a bit more reluctant to do that because I don't feel like I'm proficient, like I'm not good enough to express my own idea in a, good way, clear way. But the way I see it is that more than the language itself, is important to know the culture, the background, or at least living always to, like, having in your mind the idea that other people might have other experience and other views or other habits. So it's not people will not necessarily react as you expect them to do. And that is something very important. And that is something that I've learned in a way, also in a hard way, because it was, I know it's not much, but also the switch from Sicily to the northern part of Italy was that kind of a switch in a lot of different ways, like starting from, I know this is a very strange topic considering we are in Corona time, but physical contact. Yeah. It's normal in Sicily when you see someone, you just go and kiss him on the cheek, him or her on the cheek. If you do that in the northern part of Italy, that's weird. Don't do that. So it's not just communication. It's not necessarily a verbal language. It's also a body language. It's also all the other aspect. But I have to say that I've learned in Egypt that you don't need language to communicate, because I don't speak Arabic, and not everybody, let's say just some people in Egypt, speak either English or French. So most of the time we were trying to communicate with hands or with any kind of means we have to communicate, and it worked. It worked. There I was able to order food or to get on a cab, on a taxi, and arrive to the place where I wanted to be, or just ask information. And if you think about it, doing that without a common language can be a challenge, but it can be done.
Yeah, I think you're right. And in your examples, and also in these times, you see also there the resilience of people, the fact of being inventive in ways that even now that we can't communicate in direct ways with each other. Like you said, we can't touch each other. We can't really speak to each other from a close distance. So we invented, or we are trying to invent other ways of communication. We're doing a lot of stuff online. So you see a lot of development and evolution in these kind of online communication tools, but also even physically here in Belgium, we try to salute each other with the elbows and stuff like that. It's of course not the same, but it's a beautiful sign, I think, of a beautiful outcome of still in difficult times, people find solutions to communicate. People find ways to communicate, and I think that perfectly captures it. Yeah.